There we go. Tonight, we are working on my clip over there. Gotcha. That's okay. Tonight we're in 1 Peter chapter 3. And last week we were covering the topic of submission and the topic of submission to your slave owner or your despot. We were talking about what it looks like to submit to people, government, your bosses, those kinds of things. Before we get into tonight's submission issues and such, let's just quick do a little bit of review. Peter is writing a letter to Christians who are suffering, right? That's one of the main themes that we're looking at. People who are being persecuted and how they're supposed to operate in the midst of that persecution. Peter is this, as we've said, a very charismatic, very passionate, very obstinate, very stubborn guy who gets himself in trouble, but really passionately cares about God. And so when it comes through in his letters, he says very, very strong, he makes very strong statements about things. So, as we read this, we need to keep that setting in mind. So tonight we're going to talk about women, wives, husbands, what it means to submit, all those wonderful things, how we look at this particular text. And we're going to kind of do it in three parts. I'm going to talk a little bit, and then Ron is going to come and talk, and then I'll get back up and talk some more, and then you're going to respond. And as you think about responding, I think that this should bring up lots of questions, lots of thoughts, lots of disagreements, lots of tugging on me and on Ron and on each other. So really think about what you want to talk about, what you want to say, what God is saying to you as you listen to me and as you hear the text and as you listen to Ron speak tonight. So we're going to talk about submission. And literally the word submission means to voluntarily order yourself under someone. Submission is not a mandatory thing, at least in the context of the New Testament. Submission is a choice. I'd like to show you a clip from Robin Hood, and hopefully this works. It's the very beginning. I will warn you that someone's going to get their hand chopped off, so you might want to close your eyes if you don't like that. But the clip is not as pertinent as me wanting to just remind you of the movie so that we can talk a little bit about something. So if you would go ahead and run that, see if this.
He says you stole the bread.
It's a lie. I caught him stealing ours.
Cut off the infidel's hand. No, I took the bread.
That's not true.
I'm not interested in the truth.
But he's lying.
You're too weak, Peter. You will not live through it.
As you wish. Cut the other one's hand off as well.
I'm sorry, Robin.
Finer! Enter to the club! Bah, Finer!
No!
This is English courage.
Thank you. That's for 5 years of hell!
Behind you!
Come on, Robert, for God's sake! Come on!
Take us with you!
You cannot save those people, Christian, but you can save me!
They're coming, Robert! Robert, come on! Oh,
no. Christian! Why should I? For pity's sake. Mine is a sentence of death.
No, Robin, he's a Moor. Don't listen to him.
Set me free. I will show you a way out.
Why should we?
If you do not, we are all dead men.
No, Robin. For God's sake. Robin, come in.
I'm sorry.
Hurry. Come, Christian. Come. Robin.
This way.
Thanks. I misjudged you.
You are fast with a sword, my friend.
5 years I've waited for the smell of free air. It makes a man fast. It's mortal. Leave me. Give this ring to my sister Marion. I swear you'll protect her for me.
His wound is by the heart. We cannot save him.
Swear it, Robin.
I swear it. They're coming.
Tell Marion. I died a free Englishman.
Hooray, glory!
No!
Come, my friend. Make your sacrifice an act of honor. Come now.
Why did you have me flee, Christian?
Whatever blood is in your veins, no man deserves to die in there. Farewell, friend. Godspeed your way.
Our way lies together with the speed of Allah.
What?
You have saved my life, Christian. I will stay with you until I have saved yours. That is my vow.
Thanks, but I go to England. I relieve you of your obligation.
Only Allah can do that.
What I love about this movie is that if you really choose to want to be somebody, I'd much rather be Morgan Freeman's character because he's so much cooler than Kevin Costner. But what's interesting is you have someone who is actually more dynamic as a character in the movie and as a person even as the movie carries on. And yet what he's done, because Robin Hood saved his life, but what he's done is submitted himself to Robin Hood. It's no longer the ideas and the issues and the thoughts of Morgan Freeman's character that matter. It's actually the ideas and the thoughts and the dreams of Robin Hood that this Azim, or however you say his name, is going to spend his next year or so making happen. And so what I would like to communicate tonight as we talk about it, because we're going to talk about women submitting to men and how husbands should react to and act and treat their wives and other women. I want to say that submission is not a issue of equality. If you look at this movie, you see that these two characters are definitely equal, and yet one chooses to submit himself to the other and really make that other person's desires and needs happen. So tonight, I'm going to read just a few verses to you, and we're going to talk about it. 1 Peter chapter 3, It says, wives. In the same way, he's talking about, in the same way, slaves submit to their masters, in the same way we submit to authority. In this conversation, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives, when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. When we look at things like this, before we even start talking about what it means to you and me and how we act and how we interact and what we're supposed to do, we kind of have to take get a hold of the cultural context of things. We have to figure out who Peter is writing to. I just want you to imagine something, because this is how revolutionary Christianity is. And I think people don't realize this, but here we have, if you can imagine a room with 30 people, kind of like this, maybe a few less people. And what we have is we have some Romans, we have some Greeks, and we have some Jews. And they're all sitting around listening to this letter. That right there in the first century is mind-boggling. Because Jewish people thought that Greeks and Romans were Gentiles, unclean, you couldn't be with them. So to have those people sitting together. Now on top of that, each one of those cultures' main faiths didn't allow women to participate unless it was sexual, except for the Jewish faith. So, you have, all of a sudden, you have this group of cross-cultural interaction, and then you have all these women sitting in the same room with these men listening to this letter from Peter. Not only do you have that, but you have women who aren't with their husbands, probably either by permission of their husbands or because they've snuck away to hear this meeting, this church meeting, to listen to what Peter has to say because they just got a hold of his letter. That right there, that picture is so revolutionary and so crazy. It doesn't seem crazy to us, but it's crazy. And so you have to understand that when Peter is speaking into this culture and he's saying submit, he's speaking to a faith that's turned everything upside down. Because we have this guy named Paul who said that there's no longer Jew or Gentile, no longer male or female. There isn't any longer any division by your culture or by your sex. But one thing you have to understand about Christianity is that from Jesus on, if you read through the New Testament, you never, ever, ever will see any of our leaders, any of the apostles, trying to overthrow governmental structures, family structures of culture. They're always trying to work their way into what is already happening. And part of that is because Christianity, Jesus, God realizes that you and I live in fallen structures. And what Christianity does is lives in those structures and points to the way it should be. It lifts up the way it should be and calls people to that without saying, let's overthrow all the structures. So, if you go back to the very beginning of the Old Testament, you find this book called Genesis. And in this book called Genesis is a narrative of how the world was created. And however you like to read it, isn't really important when it comes to the way things were created. What's important is the stories that happen. And one of the stories is that the first, after God's created everything, he creates man before he creates woman. And what man finds himself doing most of the time is naming things. So he's got a long, long, long list of animals and trees and tons of things that he's got to name. And it gives us a clue as to what men are by nature. Men are by nature people who take things that are nameless and chaotic and create order to them. So by naming something, Adam gives these animals that God creates in front of him, he gives them meaning, he gives them identity, he gives them purpose by naming them. And so ultimately, what we can kind of infer from the stories in Genesis is that men, their primary way of operating in the world is to take things that are chaotic and make order out of them, to give things meaning, to create meaningful place for other things. So when God looks at this process of naming and he looks at Adam, he says in this very good creation that he declared good, something isn't good. And it is that Adam is alone. And so God creates Eve, and he says that Adam needs a helper. Now in the 21st century, helper just seems kind of lame. You know, because the way we think of helper is the guy behind or the girl behind the McDonald's counter. That's our helper, or the janitor, or we think of helper, though it's not, but we think of it in our culture because we live in a service-oriented culture. We think of it as less. But what God is saying is Adam needs a helper, but and God is called our helper. But what's interesting is this word also, I think the best way to show you this word is if you remember Two Towers, the movie, same in the book, but if you remember in the movie, how many have seen Lord of the Rings? Okay, a good portion of you have seen Lord of the Rings. So anyway, for those of you who haven't, at the very end of the movie, there's this great battle, and the good guys are pretty much going to be wiped out by all of these horrible orcs and evil things, you know. Anything that you can conjure up that's bad, it's going to overthrow the good people. And so they're kind of in this castle, and those who are left, the great knights and the leaders, are going to ride out in that last, you know, hurrah, and all, they're just going to be, you know, devoured by the darkness, and they're all, you know, getting ready, and they got their swords. It's very dramatic, and there's some slow-mo camera shots, and it's very, that's a man, okay? So they get out there, they ride out into chaos and to the impossible thing, and as they're battling and things are not going to go well, they look up on the hill, and who's on the hill? Gandalf, the wizard, and a huge army. And it comes pouring down on top of the orcs. Well, that's a woman. A woman, literally the word helper means rescuer. You know, it's used that way in a couple places in Psalms about God. Saving man. So women, really, when you think about helpers, it's not that they can't fight. It's not that they can't create order. But their purpose, really in a lot of ways, in marriage and in life, is to rescue men, is to fight alongside them, is to be the one who helps them create order, makes sense of creating order, kicks them in the butt back out the door to create order. So that's the way things are supposed to be. So when we get into a culture in this first century, we have Roman women who have very little rights under the law. We have Greek women who have are just a simple inconvenience. And we have Jewish women who are under the law property of their husbands. So we have a set of oppressed people who have been told by Paul that they're equal to everyone, that they actually get to have a voice into this faith. And Peter knows who he's writing to, and Peter says, submit to your husband. If you look at the front of your paper, we have Philippians chapter 2. One of the best ways to think about how submission works, and we'll get to husbands, it's at the end, but we'll get there. One of the ways to think about it is to think about how the Trinity works. We have God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit. All are God, all are one, but there's these three personalities. And this is, you know, what is a mystery to us and how this works. But Paul explains how Jesus submits to God the Father. And it's something that we can look to as we think about wives and husbands in relationship with each other. Verse 5 of Philippians chapter 2, we have Paul talking to the Philippians in a letter. It says, your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man. He humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. So, if you're thinking about you're a wife or you're not married and you're a woman and you're thinking about, okay, I'm going to marry a Christian man, you're going to have to wrestle with this word submission and you're going to have to come up with your own ideas about it. But let me argue this, that if you are in a marriage or if you're thinking about getting married, I would say that you need to start beginning to ask, what exactly does my husband dream about? What exactly is my husband's vision? What exactly is the man that I want to marry think about in life? Because part of being a rescuer of him is to start thinking, well, how am I going to process, how am I going to become, how are my strengths going to shore up his weaknesses? How are my, my weaknesses going to hinder him? What is it that he needs to do that I can help him with in that? You need to start processing and knowing and understanding, because realize at one level or another, no matter where you come out on submission, as a woman, you're going to end up adopting the identity of your husband. You're going to adopt his thoughts and his ways of doing things. And certainly, yes, there's all the exchange that happens within that. But philosophically, there's a process that constantly you have to look at is, what is my husband thinking? What does he want to do? Where is he going? How is he defining things? And how do I help those definitions become more definitive? So, but Peter understands that when he says that, he's also talking all of a sudden to all these women, some who are there whose husbands aren't following God, who haven't accepted God. Now you have to understand that this has to be difficult for this woman, because if this man is going to not kick her out and he's letting her go to church or letting her go to these meetings, then he's at least a very nice man. And so what Peter is saying is, do not break the family structure. Do not make everything fall apart just because now you both have two different faiths. You need to do your best by the way you behave to lead him to God. And what's interesting is that he says you shouldn't argue with them. And I think one of the things inside of marriage and then just the way we act as Christians is that we somehow believe that if you and I can come up with the right reasons for why God is true and why he's true to us, and we can convince somebody of it. And in relationships with our friends and with our spouses, that becomes more and more an issue with us, if we can just convince them. And what happens is it becomes a power play. But what Peter is saying is, no, what you need to do is behave in a certain way. And what you have to do is you need to walk purely and with reverence in front of this man with hopes that he will see God in you. He will see Christ in you. And Ron is going to talk more about why we should do all of that. But these two words, one purity, the other reverence. Ultimately, this is what submission wraps up in. It's not about the man tells you what to do and you do it, or the wife tells the man what to do and he does. It's not about a ruling. What submission is behaving around someone purely and with reverence. And this word purity is the word that in secular Greek that was used to talk about how you would bathe and how you would clean yourself before sexual activity and afterwards. That you would make yourself pure before you went into this very sacred act. And so the issue is that you are walking in such a way that's just without blame. And so really what you're doing is you're hanging on to what Jesus says is the greatest commandment. Submission looks like loving your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and loving your husband as yourself. That really submission is looking at the man that you are with and you've married and loving him the way you love yourself. And the second part is that for these people in particular, but even for us, that position of a husband and of one who identifies and creates order in things, reverence is honor. It's that you honor the position that man holds, what God has given him to define things. Now you have to understand that in Roman culture, it's very much the family values culture. For all of Roman culture is built around the family. So for Peter to try to disturb that is not a good idea. Now, Ron and I were talking, and I asked myself, if Peter were writing this to you and me, what would he be writing? Well, I have a feeling that he would write one verse to the women and 7 verses to the men, because culture has changed so much. And there's a lot of things that men need to know and don't think about. But we're going to get to what that looks like in just a minute. But what I would like to say is that when we jump forward in the 21st century, the hardest part for us as women, and I'm not a woman, but the hardest part when we hear submission is that we believe that it's stealing something from us. Like I said last week, we live in a culture where all women under the law, not necessarily in culture, but under the law are equal. And we have lots of different movements for women. But we live in this place where it says, the pursuit of happiness is your right. And when you hear someone say, you need to submit to your husband, it means that at some level the pursuit of happiness is being removed from you. That you're losing something. We'll talk more about that. But I just want to put that in your mind. And I'm going to have Ron come up here and talk. And he's going to talk through beauty and talk about submission a little bit more. And I would like you to give him more grace than you give me ever standing up here, because I'm asking a single man to talk about beauty of women and submission. So honor him in that.
How we're doing on sound. All right. Functional microphone. Yeah, so my job is to explain why it is that Peter says that a wife submitting to her husband makes her beautiful. So, hi, ladies. I'm just going to start by reading the passage, and I'm going to pick up where Eric left off, beginning in verse 3, going through to verse 6. It says, "Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as braided hair and the wearing of gold jewelry and fine clothes. Instead, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. For this is the way the holy women of the past, who put their hope in God, used to make themselves beautiful. They were submissive to their own husbands, like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her master. You are her daughters if you do what is right and do not give in to fear." So it seems that Peter is giving us the connections between beauty, submission, and fear. But before I get into what Peter is saying with these verses, I would like to go over what he's not saying in this passage, because I think one of the things that would be tempting to do with this is treat it somehow as an isolated dissertation on beauty. But it's not, right? Because Peter isn't speaking these words on beauty into a vacuum. He's addressing how it is that a wife's disposition toward and behavior with her husband contributes to her beauty. So, neither is this a prohibition on jewelry and braided hair and things like clothes. Right? Peter isn't saying you shouldn't wear jewelry and wear nice clothes at all. I think this is kind of like telling a decorated war hero as he goes back into battle that he can't just strut out onto the field and expect that his medals are going to communicate to the enemy and to his fellow soldiers his skill and bravery, right? But that instead he should act skillfully and courageously. So that's not addressing whether you should wear the medals at all, just like Peter isn't addressing whether you should wear jewelry at all. What it is doing is giving you a limit on what you can expect jewelry and clothes to accomplish. And I think the third thing that this passage is not, is it's not a comprehensive account of the nature of beauty. This isn't Peter's full, complete explanation of what beauty is. So to summarize, this isn't an isolated explanation of beauty. It's not a prohibition on jewelry and nice clothes. And it's also not a comprehensive account of what beauty is. In fact, if we look at the word beauty in this passage, the Greek word is kosmos, which literally translates as adornment. So to make beautiful is to adorn, to ornament, or to embellish with honor. So what Peter is saying here then is that women already have value or honor. It's what they start with. And so it's this value and honor that they were created with, and it's the value and honor that Jesus restored in them. And beauty is a part of that value. Right? Not that it's a separable component of their value, but that it somehow permeates or emerges from the way God made them. So women are already beautiful. And what Peter then is saying is that focusing on things like jewelry and clothes is not the best way to embellish that beauty. But that having a gentle and quiet spirit is a way that women can visibly adorn themselves with beauty. Or, as we say quite often around here, offer their beauty. And before I go on with that, I'm going to do a quick aside and say that this gentle and quiet spirit that Peter is talking about is not something that women exclusively are called to. It's this kind of meekness that any follower of Christ should exhibit, right, regardless of gender. So that said, why? Why should women offer their beauty in this way? Certainly it's not because the world deserves it. Right? Eric had talked a couple of weeks ago about women being strangers in this world. And I was talking to some beautiful and wise women the other night who told me that this is a culture that says that sex equals love, that a woman's attractiveness begins and ends with physical exhibitionism, and that, in fact, it's girls gone wild, so to speak, who are offering their value. So I wish I could say that this isn't a culture that I've ever belonged to. I mean, it's something that I've struggled with. Like, I've had a hard time understanding what it is that makes women valuable, and I've had a hard time combating these messages that I get from culture. But it's God's grace and redemption that has allowed me to challenge some of these messages. And one of the strongest ways that God has expressed this grace to me is by putting women who do act confidently out of the identity they have in Christ in my path. So, again, I'll say there's nothing that this world, and namely there's nothing that the men in this world, have done to earn the privilege of experiencing a woman's value, like what Peter is saying. So, if it's not the case that the world deserves it, why offer it? Well, I think that when you embellish your beautiful and godly nature, what you do is allow people to recognize and glorify God. And so I think this is what Peter has said already in his letter, looking at chapter 2, verse 12. This is on the inside page of the handout. I'm just going to skip right to verse 12 where he says, "Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us." So when you embellish your value like this, what you're doing is allowing people to recognize God and glorify him. But ultimately, it's to God's credit and for God's sake. I think this is kind of like a teacher who has an especially good student. Like, the student is conscientious, caring, confident, humble, obedient, and the teacher doesn't know why the student is behaving this way until the student's parents come to pick them up. And then the teacher will immediately recognize in those parents that the parents are wise, and the parents discipline in love, and that the parents are caring and gentle. And so if the teacher were to take the student alone, they wouldn't know how or why the student behaves well. And if the teacher were to take the parents by themselves, they probably wouldn't completely understand what's valuable about those parents. But when the two are brought together, the teacher can credit the student's good behavior to the parents. I think in the same way, when women embellish the value that they have in God, people, when they see God, when God visits, will be able to glorify him. Now, this isn't to say that having a gentle and quiet spirit with a husband, that submitting isn't terrifying. I think that any form of submission is really scary. And I think it's scary for a couple of reasons. The first is that when you decide to submit to somebody, to a certain extent, you give up your right to defend yourself or defend your identity with that authority. The other reason it's scary is because deciding to follow a flawed person is just inherently dangerous, especially men. You're not just following a flawed person, you're following somebody who himself is cowardly. I can say this of men because I know at least I'm a big chicken. No, really, I was hoping I would get run over by a truck or something before I came, so I wouldn't have to speak tonight. But going back to the first reason, it's scary to submit yourself to somebody. Giving up the ability to defend yourself and your identity against your authority seems to me like it's an impossibly hard calling, which I'm pretty sure is why Peter tells us how it's possible. And he says this right after he's told servants to submit to their masters, with chapter 2, verses 21 to 25, also in the handout. He says, to this, and I'll insert submission, to this submission you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. He committed no sin, and no deceit was found in his mouth. When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, so that we might die to sins and live for righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed, for you were like sheep going astray, but now you have returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. So Jesus' alternative to retaliating against those who were insulting him and those who were causing him to suffer was committing himself to God's judgment. And I think this is the only way we can keep ourselves from retaliating against our authorities, who oftentimes will insult and cause us suffering. Doing this, though, is not easy. And how we do it, I don't think is obvious. I know it's been tough for me. I mean, the messages that I've gotten from my authorities haven't always been edifying. I heard from a boss once that the work I had done that day had actually cost the company more than I was being paid that day. So this isn't the first time I've been told I'm incompetent. I've heard it from a lot of different places, and frankly, I believed it for a really long time. And it kept me from giving myself wholly to the work. It kept me from really submitting to those authorities. So even though I would follow their mandates to the letter, I would never really be submitted to them. And even though I'm not a husband, I think I can say that a husband's words aren't always going to uphold his wife's beauty and value. I think that's safe to say. And I think it's safe to say that oftentimes a husband does the opposite. How then is a wife supposed to withhold contempt from a husband who's treating her contemptuously? Well, as we have the example of Christ, the only way she can do it is entrust herself to God's judgment rather than her husband's, because God tells her she's valuable and because God tells her she's beautiful. So she can't entrust herself to her husband's judgment. And because this is an issue of the heart, if she doesn't believe she's beautiful, she has to mistrust herself and instead believe what God says about her in Isaiah 61:3. Which is that she's been given a crown of beauty. And this is something that we've been talking about as accepting the identity that God gives you. And so just real briefly, I'll talk about identity. Identity, if we want to define it, just generally speaking, we would say that two things are identical if they share all the same properties. And so identity determines our uniqueness and our sameness, and it has to do with properties. And properties that don't count in defining our identity are those things that are believed about us and those things that are said about us. So when my boss told me I was incompetent, that didn't make me incompetent. That didn't count towards my identity. And even though in that instant I believed I was incompetent, That also didn't make me incompetent. On the other hand, what we can trust is that what God says about us and what God believes about us is true of us. And so, when we entrust ourselves to God's judgment, what we're doing is believing what God says about our identity. Now, as for being brave as you follow somebody who himself is inherently flawed, I think this is why Peter gives us the example of Sarah, because the example of Sarah's relationship with Abraham is just perfect. So we're gonna go back and look at how Sarah obeyed Abraham and the circumstances where she did actually call him master. So we're gonna go to Genesis 20, and we're entering the story here where Abraham has told Sarah that she should call herself his sister so that the people in the land where he is won't kill him to get to her. And so this obviously doesn't go well for him. And what we're seeing is Abimelech, the local king, who did actually take Sarah away from him, asking him why he told her to call herself and his sister. So starting in verse 10, and Abimelech asks Abraham, "What was your reason for doing this?" Abraham replied, "I said to myself, there surely is no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she really is my sister, the daughter of my father, though not of my mother, and she became my wife. And when God had me wander from my father's household, I said to her, this is how you can show your love for me. Everywhere we go, say of me, he is my brother." And Sarah obeyed, which is surprising, because this is really audacious of Abraham to ask. It's crazy. I mean, how could you ask your wife to call herself your sister so that you won't be killed, but she has to face all the consequences? And it's especially audacious of him to say this because it's the second time this has happened. Earlier in their journey when they went to Egypt, he asked Sarah to say the same thing, and the same thing happened. Pharaoh took Sarah away from Abraham. But what's important is that when Pharaoh took Sarah away from Abraham, it wasn't Abraham who rescued her. It was actually God who took her away from Pharaoh and gave her back to Abraham. This is how, when it happens again, she can obey him just the same way she did the first time. She doesn't trust Abraham, but she does trust God. So let's look now at where she calls Abraham master. This is the last page of the handout, Genesis 18. We're going to enter this story where Abraham is in a meeting with God. So he's having a conversation with God. And it says, starting with this highlighted section, "While they ate, he stood near them under a tree. 'Where is your wife Sarah?' they asked him. 'There in the tent,' he said. Then the Lord said, 'I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, will have a son.' Now Sarah was listening at the entrance to the tent, which was behind him. Abraham and, and Sarah were already old and well advanced in years, and Sarah was past the age of childbearing. So Sarah laughed to herself as she thought, 'After I am worn out and my master is old, will I now have this pleasure?'" So here we see Sarah calling Abraham her master. But while she does this, even though she has obeyed him and she has exhibited a gentle and quiet spirit, she is, in fact, all up in Abraham's business. Specifically, she's up in his business with God. Because she's learned that it's not Abraham that she's trusting, but that it is God who's trustworthy. And so she's interested to hear what God has to say to Abraham while she treats Abraham as her master. And in fact, this is another good example of how Sarah has given into fear, because it goes on to say, "Then the Lord said to Abraham, 'Why did Sarah laugh and say, will I really have a child now that I am old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? I will return to you at the appointed time next year, and Sarah will have a son.' Sarah was afraid, so she lied and said, 'I did not laugh.' But he said, 'Yes, you did laugh.'" So Sarah, she didn't always act bravely. And in this case, she did give in to fear. She gave in to fear because what God was saying about her was absurd. Because God was telling her, "You're going to have a son," and the circumstances that she was aware of didn't permit that to happen. And I think a lot of times when God tells us things about ourselves, it does sound absurd to us. And so while Sarah is incredulous and while she laughs, it doesn't change the fact that she's going to have a son. Right? Later on in the story, we see that God is gracious to her and he does give her a son. And so even though we may disbelieve what God says about us, and even though we may act out of fear in response to it, it doesn't change who we are in God, and it doesn't change the fact that he will extend grace to us, even when we fail. So, with that, I'll hand things back over to Eric.
Thanks, Ron. So, cool. Submission makes women beautiful. Now, just to clarify, we're not talking about or arguing for women to stay in abusive relationships. That's not what we're talking about. Again, we have to go back to any time that God is talking to social issues, he's talking about the way things should be. And any time God talks about one person's responsibility, he talks about the other person's responsibility, and he flips it over. And so my job here in the short time that I have is to talk to husbands. So verse 7, and men who want to be husbands. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives, and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. I like that he says husbands in the same way, just as he said wives in the same way. There's a sense that that husbands, wives, slaves, us as a community are subjecting ourselves to somebody. And so actually Peter is asking husbands to subject themselves to him. And so he's saying, in the same way, I want you to be considerate. I was attempting to download off of YouTube the My Fair Lady song, you know, why can't a woman be more like a man, Henry Higgins. But man, that's an absurdly painful song to listen to. I didn't want to make you guys have to listen to it. But you know what? I have talked to so many guys in this community and outside who actually really, that is one of the struggles. It is the default of men, is that we're just like, why can't women be more like men? Why can't they think the way we think? And often there's a frustration in not understanding. But really the considerate part that God is calling men to as husbands, men just don't like doing things. I mean, we don't like thinking. I mean, it's really, really, really hard for us, because really ultimately, like when Christopher Robin was made, that whole story, Pooh Bear really was men. I mean, men's heads are stuffed with fluff, and it's hard for us, you know, it's hard enough for us to be in the world, we think. It's so exhausting to try to figure out how to make meaning in things. Now we have to try to figure out what women are thinking about. But what Peter is saying is, and this is the important part, men, husbands, is that part of your role, the who you are, is to actually think about your wife. We talk about this in this community all the time, about being intentional. But being a good husband is being intentionally thoughtful about your wife. Being a good boyfriend is being intentionally thoughtful about your wife. Being a good man is being intentionally thoughtful of women, thinking about them as you live with them and hang out with them. And it says that you should treat them with respect as the weaker partner. And I love this part, because you can read that and be, what do you mean weaker partner? But literally, it actually, the words in the Greek mean they are constructed differently. So it's the idea that when you think about like a flower versus a brick, right? Both have value and importance. One is very functional and one is very beautiful, but you can drop the brick on the flower, right? And it breaks and it busts. And so what Peter is saying is, he's saying to a very Eastern society where you see donkeys loaded with, you know, loaded down, and then the man's riding on top of the donkey and the woman is walking next to him. He's speaking into a society where chivalry is not an idea. See, Christians invented chivalry. There was no such thing as chivalry until Christianity came. And this is where it comes from. this idea that men and women are constructed differently physically, and that they're constructed differently physically for a purpose. And part of that construction, and part of what Peter is saying to husbands is, they're constructed beautiful, and you need to be aware of that as you create space and live with them. And so, this is as simple as, you know, when you see a woman trying to lift something that she can't lift, you go lift it for her, right? It's that idea of chivalry. So what he's saying is that not only should you think of this woman, you have to think of women in that context, that they're built and constructed for a different purpose and a different way of being than you. And so when you consider them, you have to hold on to that, and you have to think about that, and you have to consider it. But I like what he adds on. He says, but they are equal heirs. So he's saying this weakness is not something that's a level thing, a power structure. He's saying that this weakness doesn't mean that we're not equal. It actually means that we're both inherit the kingdom of God the same way. So we both step into life and into the kingdom of God the same way. We share it. It's not like God says, oh, woman, you need to get to the back of the line. You step into the kingdom the same way as your husband or as men do. And I love this last part. It says that you need to do this because if you don't, your prayers are going to be hindered. And I read a lot of commentators. I liked one commentator who said that if a husband prays and his wife is crying because he hurt her, God's not going to listen to her because he's listening to the crying of a woman and not to the request of a man. But really what I think Peter is trying to say is that your whole spiritual life as a husband revolves around the way you interact with your wife. The way God interacts with you, understands you, walks with you and your purpose is the way that you treat your wife. That is a reflection of being, of your spiritual life, and of how you demonstrate Christ to the world. Now, I'm going to close with this, and we started church late, so we're running a little late, and I'm sorry about that, but you'll just have to hang on. This last thing, the reason that I think that Peter would talk about, give us 6 verses to men and 1 verse to women, is that if you look at our culture, and if you really just take me at face value and believe me that women are supposed to, or men are supposed to create order, what we've done in a culture is we've created a very unsafe place for women. Where what Ron said, those young women told him about how beauty has to do with sex and exhibitionism, where it's very unsafe to be, both in marriages and in just in life. I think what Peter would say is, as he would say, men, get your butt in gear and start speaking out against injustice. And that speaking out against injustice begins with your wife. It begins with your sister. It begins with the women in your community. First, it begins with you being willing to speak the words that Jesus speaks to them and hold those up. But also, I think when we talk about how we function in government and submitting to authority, men's role in the culture is to step out and say, no, the way the culture looks at these places at women is not right. And it needs to change. Now, it doesn't need to change by rules. It needs to change by men acting differently. And so I guess my challenge to you guys, if you're a man thinking about getting married, or if you're a husband, what does it look like for you to consider your wife or future wife? What does it look like for you to understand them as weaker? Because that's kind of hard for us to do. And then what places, what social areas do you entertain and engage in that are against women? Where do you participate as a man and as a husband and things in our culture that violate women? What are you doing in those? Because you need to begin the process of stopping, because they have a direct impact on your spiritual life, and they're damaging to your brothers and sisters and your wife. Well, with that said, I'm sure there's a lot of things I probably have forgotten to say and Ron has forgotten to say. I want to just give you a few minutes to respond, and then we're going to change gears. So do you have anything to say, or do you want me to close? Any questions? Thoughts? Sure. Ron, you can come up here. Just speak loud.
So if your identity comes from God, then it's on you. And that is what enables you to bring to someone that makes you think. How do I let your husband impact you without that freedom of making
But you're asking, how is it that you can even let somebody have an effect on you at all?
Right.
Because a husband doesn't always affect you negatively.
Right, but I want my husband to make an impact on me. And yet, that takes time.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think we can't change our beliefs by flipping a switch. Right, when we trust what God says about us, I think instead of choosing to believe instantaneously that I'm beautiful because God says I'm beautiful, and trusting yourself to that is pursuing it, is pursuing that as true. Right? And because it is true, to the extent that you pursue it, you'll realize that it's the case. And so I think maybe letting your husband reinforce some of those things is one way you can do that. And there are probably a lot of women here who can answer that a lot more thoroughly and better than I can. So, thank you.
Right. Sure, sure. She said if God is... Yeah, right. If the woman is the helper, then the guy needs help, is what she's saying. he needs some help. I would say that, honestly, just right, I disagree with John, and that's about as simple as... And then Jeff. What happens to the woman's desires? Well, I think that part of, like, I think that that's why Christianity, like, when Peter talks about women submitting, he flips it and talks about men and the way they treat women and how they interact. Because I think what he's saying is that if you take what I said earlier, if the way it's supposed to be is a man is creating order, and that's what he does, and a woman comes alongside of him, and rescues him. And if you think about that illustration of two towers, it's not that army up on the hill has like a different, they just bring some, you know, blah thing. They bring a very unique way of fighting and a very who they are to the picture. It's not like they're, so I think, yes, you come alongside and you're offering all the who you are. So your desires, your way of being, is to come alongside the husband and what he's doing. So I still think, though, when you choose to marry a man, you better figure out what he's thinking, because he's going to push hard on that, because that's who he is, to define things and to make things. Then I'm going to go back to Jeff. No, go ahead, and then you can... Yeah, go ahead, and then I'll grab Jeff. Sure.
But women, because they have more things to pursue, they sometimes
Sure. Sure, sure. No. Yes, exactly. No, I would totally, yes, I would totally agree. Yeah, I'm going to go with Jeff. I'm going to go, hang on, I'm going to go with Jeff, but then I'll, oh, you want, I'll quick, sorry, I thought you were, she basically said that not only is a man, you know, going out and creating order and such, but that he's also creating a space for a woman to develop in who she is and her longings and her desires and her, you know, what's important to her. And so I'm going to ask Jeff and then Julie and then I'm going to close. And Ron and Ryan and Doctor. We'll start with Jeff. Then we need to close because we're running out of time. Sure. 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 Right. Yes. Yeah, and then we're trying to push them down. I understand what you're saying. Exactly. Right. This is very true. Yeah, you're also not creating order. Yeah. Sure. Very good, and I'm not going to give anybody any more voice. I'm sorry, but hey! Yes.